The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Warkey, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have several cases on our calendar. The one and only case that we have today for our oral calendar is this one. This is case number A22-0195, in re the marriage of Amy Jo Kemp versus Michael Edward Kemp. We appreciate your flexibility in terms of changing this oral argument from in-person to Zoom due to a rescheduling of another case, which meant this case was the only one that we had. So we appreciate your flexibility with us today here. We will have 15 minutes for oral arguments by appellant, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. Please note that we have a timer on the screen so you can monitor how much time you have for your oral arguments. This is being recorded. No other recordings are permitted, but this one will be available within a day or two after for anyone who wishes to listen to the or re-listen to the oral arguments. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Thank you, Judge Reyes, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Warkey, Michael Boulette. May it please the court, here on behalf of appellant Michael Kemp. Your Honors, the central question this appeal poses is what it takes for a district court to move a child 500 miles away from their parent. By the district court's rationale, what it takes is a temporary order issued amidst very explosive but ultimately unproven allegations, and then the mere passage of time. As that order becomes the child's new status quo. And after that passage of time, the district court is then permitted to rely on a status quo it created as a fait accompli. Below, that is precisely what happened, and it resulted in a series of cascading errors that interrelate. The first, in principle, is that the district court confused the question it was at. The district court actually had to make two separate inquiries. One was the appropriate physical custodian. That's not challenged on appeal. But the second is the minor child's residence, a concept that is distinct from physical custody and so requires distinct analysis and distinct best interest findings. Unfortunately, leading to the second error, the only analysis and best interest findings we have rest on the minor child's presence out of state due to a prior temporary order. That reliance itself is legal error because the statute tells us that temporary orders cannot be used to prejudice a child's rights to be determined later in the proceeding. They cannot be used as a starting point that benefits or detriments one party or the other. The same error that led to the assignment of the child's residence then cascades into parenting time.
Doesn't that, Mr. Boulette, really mean, though, when you're talking about prejudice, that the district court should make its determination without being influenced by a prior award? I mean, how do you define the prejudice that the statute refers to?
Well, I think that you actually formulate it very well, Judge Warkey, that you can't be influenced by the prior award. And so when you look at the findings that are made here, right, it's that the minor child has become settled in the state that was chosen on a temporary basis, and that it would be unfair to upset that now.
Is that not just real life? And unfortunately, in all of these situations, we deal with what life dishes out, whether it's the passage of time that contributes to that or whether it's the age of the child. I just don't know how we can sparse this out to talk about prejudice. And I know you are urging us to have a precedential opinion on this, but I can't even in my head imagine what kind of a syllabus point there would be.
Well, I think that Judge Warkey, maybe I can offer a couple points because it's an excellent question, but it's a broad one. The first would be, what is prejudice? How do we understand prejudice? And part of the reason appellant urges you to publish is that the family law bar is asking exactly the same question. What is prejudice? I think there are some forms of prejudice we can easily identify. When a temporary order is treated as a permanent order and then subject to the standards for modification, that would result in choosing the wrong legal standard. That's clear prejudice. But some of the non-precedential case law gives us other standards that can be helpful here. When an order is used to the benefit or detriment of either party, when an order becomes a starting point for the analysis, rather than simply part of understanding the history of the case. And the reason that these factual kinds of prejudice matter is because when a court issues a temporary order, it in essence creates a bit of a Schrodinger's cat problem, right? We open that box and we have irrevocably changed the facts of the case. When M.A.K. went with her mother to Illinois, we can never know what would have happened had she stayed in Minnesota, as father urged. And so the challenge becomes that now the case develops, it shifts in other directions, and we can't know what the contrast would have been. So while we don't ask the court to turn a blind eye to changes as they develop, these orders can't become fait accompli. Otherwise, when you have these extended cases like here, and part of that was the COVID pandemic, that for which no one is to blame. But when you have these extended cases, the decision a court makes with extremely limited information, without a right of appeal, without best interest findings, takes on a life of its own, and parties are no longer addressing what's best for the children. They're playing against or with the clock. And that
brings me to my next question, because you're citing 518.131 and the family bar wanting to have an answer to this. But, you know, you talk about the rights of the parties, plural, and how the rights of the parties can be prejudiced as a result. But what about or of the child? Aren't we, in a way, if we adopt your viewpoint, aren't we subordinating the rights of the child to the rights of a parent?
I think actually exactly the opposite, Judge Werke, because this child also had a right to have her residence determined based on what would really meet her best interest, not simply what's going to happen as a result of the passage of time. She also had the right to a minimum amount of time to develop that safe, stable, nurturing relationship with her father, which the district court found was impossible because the parents lived in different states and the district court wouldn't assign a residence here. She also has a right, she also has a right to a set amount of time with her father, a possibility that the district court found precluded in just a few months from now when the child turns 5. So we agree with you. This is about the child's right. And it's not just father's rights that have been prejudiced here. It is undoubtedly the child's rights to exactly those things I described.
But isn't your argument really saying, well, the court erred because the burden should have been on the mom, not on dad? I mean, that's really what you're saying, because nobody's going to suggest it's great for a 3.5-year-old kid to travel 8 hours to spend a few days with either parent.
And Judge Siegel, can I clarify your question, which is, do you mean the burden should have been on mom to relocate, or the burden should have been on mom to...
No, what you're calling as error. I mean, it seems to me that what the court did was, I mean, first, well, let me back up a minute, because I've got a question for you. So the court made a finding of fact about what the understanding of the parties was, whether it was a temporary move to Illinois or a permanent move. And the court made a finding on that. And are you challenging that factual finding?
I don't know that the court,
The court made a finding that there was no such agreement that the move to Illinois was just going to be temporary.
Right.
At least that's how I read the orders.
I guess, Judge Siegel, what I would say is my reading of the record and the order is that there is no finding by the court in either direction as to what the parties intended. Mother testified to one thing, father to another, the custody evaluator to a third. The court, to my reading of its order, does not reconcile that respective testimony. But I apologize if I'm looking perhaps to a different portion of the record than you.
No. Okay. All right.
Counsel, I have a couple of questions as well. First of all, you mentioned that the district court failed to make appropriate best interest findings. But when I read the district court's order, the district court went through each and every single factor that was relevant and did make findings on each one. And in fact, stated whether or not it was neutral or favored one party or the other. So I'm just curious, are you still challenging the best interest findings by the district court?
And let me be clear as to the nature in which we are challenging the findings. There's not a challenge that the findings are sufficient to support the legal custody decision. There's not a challenge that the findings are sufficient to support the physical custody decision. The challenge is that those findings are sufficient to support essentially a de facto residence determination, right? That in many cases that I handle, I'm sure many family practitioners handle, there isn't truly a debate about residence, right? Mom lives in Minneapolis, dad lives in Edina. We don't really think too much about the child's residence, but it is an independent issue that also has to be fixed. And the best interest factors here do not speak in any meaningful way to the question of the child's residence, separate and apart from custody label. And that becomes a particular problem because of the interplay with the temporary order, that the only best interest findings that we have rely expressly on a status quo the court created through a temporary order. So to the refinement of maybe your question, Judge Reyes, we challenge the best interest findings and analysis insofar as they relate to residence.
Okay. And the second question I have is to our standard of review. Our standard of review is to determine whether or not the district court abused its discretion in any of these findings and determinations. And quite frankly, we give the district court fairly broad discretion there, including making credibility determinations, which we don't question because we weren't there. We didn't hear the parties. We didn't hear the witnesses. We didn't hear all the people who spoke at that time. So you keep referring to error by the court, but really it's whether or not the district court abused its discretion. And I'm struggling to find how the district court abused its discretion here when it weighed all the factors, it looked at the prior history. It's very well aware of all the issues that were raised between the parties, but seemed to really focus on what is in the best interest of the child, which is really the heart of any of these determinations that are being challenged on appeal. So I'm curious as to, I'm still struggling with, what is your argument in terms of how the district court used its discretion here by taking into account all these different factors?
So excellent question, Judge Reyes, and let me see if I can distill it into a relatively brief point. We are not here disputing the district court's credibility determinations. Many of those credibility determinations actually favored father in this case, where he was found to be credible and his version of the relationship was found to be more credible than mother's claims of abuse and chemical dependency. What we are here to challenge is the misapplication of the law, which is also another way in which district courts can abuse their discretion. And here that misapplication of the law takes a few forms. It takes the form of not recognizing that it wasn't enough to pick mother as the physical custodian. There was another analysis to do, another layer of analysis to do on residence that was separate and apart from the question of who should have physical custody. And we see that issue present, for instance, in LaChapelle versus Mitten. There's another area of misapplication of the law when the district court is relying for its findings and analysis, and as well as basing its findings and analysis on a temporary order that can't create prejudice when in fact it did.
Are you finished?
Two more, Judge Werke.
Go ahead.
There's a further misapplication of the law when the district court looks at the 25% parenting presumption and treats residence as a foregone conclusion. We have, the legislature has provided us a minimum presumption of parenting time, a floor. And for the court to simply say, well, I've already chosen resident, so the 25% presumption disappears, can't be the way the legislature intended to protect parent-child relationships. And finally, we have a misapplication of the law and thus an abuse of discretion because the district court sets a temporary parenting time schedule that goes poof and disappears as soon as this child turns 5, meaning that once she turns 5, which happens very soon, she has no guaranteed time with her father, and there is no basis from which we can determine what standard of, what burden of proof or what legal standard will apply to determine what her time with her father will be later on. So, Judge Reyes, I appreciate your point, but it is those legal errors that create an abuse of discretion that warrants a reversal and a remand with instructions.
So my question, Mr. Goulet, is actually you can think about it and when you have rebuttal, maybe come up with an idea. Seriously, if you want to help this panel, I still am at a loss at what a syllabus point would be that would assist the family law bar. And that's my concern because of the fact that life is fluid and things change. I want to direct your attention quickly to the child support matter. Is this a child support matter, if we disagree with you on the custody, is this a child support matter that's just simply typographical errors that we could remedy or fix ourselves, or is this something that needs to be sent back to the district court?
It is possible that the arrearage issue could be fixed itself if we, with 20% of fathers.
And I'm sorry, I should have been clear. I was talking about the arrearage issue. The child hadn't even been born, and we have an order that starts child support.
Right. So I think the arrearage issue, kind of father has to pay 20% of something. What? The order says 20% of the arrearage, suggesting he has to pay $3,500 a month. Statute sets a limit at 20% of father's obligation, which is about $350 a month. That could potentially be fixed as a typographical error. The selection of a retroactive date is a bit of a discretionary issue, right? As counsel points out, as a general rule, we don't go back in time and start child support obligations before a divorce starts, but there is some discretion for a district court to do that. That may require remand, unless the court just agrees that child support should have began when the divorce was started. My time is up, so I will reserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record, the party you are representing, and you may begin.
Amy Kemp, and I was on mute that time. My name is Sharon Markowitz, and I represent respondent Amy Kemp. Father's argument is contrary to Minnesota law, and it leads to three illogical outcomes, some of which some of you have alluded to. First, under father's argument, a district court must make custody, residency, and parenting time decisions that are actually contrary to the best interests of the child at the time of the order, if the child's interests are influenced at least in part by facts that flow from a temporary order. Second, under father's argument, a district court must set a permanent parenting time schedule, even though the family circumstances are likely to evolve. And the parties aren't even permitted to agree to take their disputes to a parenting time consultant. Instead, every time they want to change, they have to bring it back to the district court. And third, under father's argument, it is only under unusual circumstances that a child has a right to financial support from a non-custodial parent during the period of the parent separation before their divorce. I'd like to address just a few points in the reply brief and that came up in oral argument. First, as Judge Werke mentioned, there are all sorts of bad facts that influence a district court's determination of what's in the child's best interest. The parties make bad decisions that hurt the child, and it's possible that a district court would make an error in a temporary order. And that order is not on appeal, so we can't judge that here. But we look at the facts as they exist at the time that the court is issuing its permanent custody and residency order. We don't say, what would be the child's interest if I could do something different in the past? This is about the child's rights and not about the party's rights. And although counsel mentions that, you know, the child has a right to a relationship with her father and things like that, the district court found that father had the ability to move to Illinois. He still does. That's an option. I also want to address this notion that there's no legal standard or burden for changing parenting time in the future and that father somehow loses all parenting time ability. That's not true. The statute that we cite in our brief on page 15 says that the court can reserve a determination as to future establishment or expansion of parenting time. And in that event, the best interest standard shall be applied. In other words, you don't have to show change of circumstances. You don't have to show endangerment of the child. Neither party bears a burden. Instead, the district court looks at what is in the child's best interest going forward when it comes to parenting time. One other item on back child support. Father argues that he has preserved this issue, and he cites a portion of the trial testimony. It doesn't support his argument. Here's what happened. Mother's counsel submitted an exhibit to the court with her calculation of back child support. Father's counsel, who was new at the time, objected that she wasn't sure whether mother had preserved the issue of back support for trial. The district court said that she had and admitted the exhibit. There was no discussion of when child support should begin. On a later day of trial, however, father submitted his own numbers to the court, and he calculated back support starting as of the date of separation. So it's no surprise that the district court didn't explain why she started back child support at the date of separation. The parties had both agreed to that. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Yeah, counsel, I do have a question here, and it kind of goes to what I think is really the heart of the dispute here as to whether or not there is any de facto presumption once a child's residence is established with one parent or the other. And quite frankly, we see this a lot in family law cases. I'm sure the family bar sees this all the time as well. It could be one parent moving with a child out of state, or it could be one parent moving within the state, but to a location that is quite a distance away. You know, so there's a big state. If they move, let's say, from the Twin Cities to Moorhead, that's a 4-hour drive for one party. Here's my concern is when a district court provides in a temporary order and allows one parent to have sole physical custody, and that child then is residing with that parent that has sole physical custody, even if parties have joint legal custody, and reserves the issue of determining whether you know, who will have permanent custody, but more importantly, where the child's permanent residence will be. Doesn't it result in a de facto presumption that the parent with sole physical custody and where the child is residing will then become the permanent residence of that child?
Not at all. I think that stability is certainly important, and that would...
The question is, why not? Because I think this is an important issue, and we see this playing out all the time. It could be father, it could be mother, it could be within Minnesota, it could be outside of Minnesota. But we see it all the time where there's a parent who gets sole physical custody and temporary residence with that. That child has temporary residence with that parent. But then it almost seems like that becomes a presumption, almost like an unrebuttable presumption after that.
Well, it certainly wasn't an unrebuttable or even a rebuttable presumption here. The district court did not simply say, MAK is in Illinois and it's best for her to stay there for stability reasons. Instead, what the district court did is she looked at, first of all, how MAK was doing in Illinois and found that she was doing well. She also found that MAK's mother was doing well there and had established a stable and sober lifestyle in Illinois, which she had not done in Minnesota. The district court also looked at other factors related to Minnesota and Illinois that had nothing to do.
I know this is a little hard over Zoom, so I apologize. But I want to stop you there because those two factors would not have been established but for the fact that the district court granted mother temporary sole physical custody and established the residence with mother. And so those two factors that you are weighing would not have occurred but for that prior order. So why are those factors even appropriate factors for the district court to consider? It seems like those are not appropriate because they wouldn't have occurred but for that temporary residence order.
I think they are appropriate because the district court needs to look at what is the reality of the situation. That reality may flow from a temporary order that might be right or wrong. It might also flow from bad or good decisions of the parents. But she can't just ignore the child's current circumstances and say, I'm going to do something that's not in the child's best interest because the child's best interests are influenced by something I did.
Okay.
Can
I stop you there then? Let me ask you this question. Let's assume for the sake of argument, I hate to get into hypotheticals, but I think it's appropriate in this situation. Let's assume for the sake of the argument that the district court in its temporary order said father will have sole legal custody and child's residence will be in Minnesota. I understand mother moving to Illinois and why she's moving there, but let's assume the district court did say that. Now, isn't mother at a disadvantage in terms of trying to establish child's residence in Illinois if the situation was reversed?
Sure. But Minnesota law doesn't say that divorced parents need to always get fairness. It says that the child's best interests win.
Okay,
so yeah, it would be less good for mother, but we'd still look to what's best for the child.
Okay, so you agree then, if father had gotten the residence in a temporary order and sole physical custody, that mother would have been disadvantaged. Isn't that because of the presumption? That
not necessarily. No, I mean, what if MAK lived in Minnesota and was not doing well? She was showing signs of depression or anxiety, whatever sort of problems that children under the age of four have. If the child isn't thriving in Minnesota, that might cut against father. And that's exactly what the district court did.
Ms. Markowitz, would you agree that if, in fact, dad had the residence of the child until where we're at now, that mother would have had the same ability to move back to Minnesota?
Yes, and she testified that she would have done so. Father, on the other hand, did not move to Illinois. I also want to point out the district court did look at other things related to residency that have nothing to do with the temporary order. She looked at, you know, the opportunities in Illinois and Minnesota. She simply found that those were neutral factors. If she didn't limit her review to the child is in Illinois, therefore the child is should stay in Illinois. She said the child is doing well in Illinois. Mother is doing well in Illinois. And there are other things about Illinois and Minnesota that are equal.
Ms. Markowitz, I'm sorry, Judge Reyes, I was going to turn the table to the back support, so I'll cede to you if you're following the.
Yes, I just have one final question on this. And opposing counsel raised this issue in terms of precedential point. If we were to make this precedential, what would your syllabus point be on this, knowing that you may very well may have clients in the future that might be on the other end of this situation?
Or you may not think it should be precedential.
If you were to make a syllabus point on this, I would say that a temporary order cannot legally prejudice a permanent order. And that means, and I think our brief lays out three bullet points of ways that something can legally prejudice a party. It can change the burden of proof in a subsequent decision. It can require the district court to explain its rationale for deviating from the temporary order. And what was the third one? It can't limit the scope of a subsequent order. A temporary order shouldn't legally prejudice a party in the future in those ways. It doesn't mean that a temporary order can't create facts that the district court has to turn a blind eye to when evaluating the child's best interest going forward. And I am very comfortable, whether that is good or bad for my clients in the future, because under Minnesota law, it's really not about the parents. It's about the child. I see that Judge Werke stepped away. I'm very excited for the back child support question, though.
I'm sorry, I have my phone still on, so it was ringing in the background. I had to go turn it off. So, when I was reading the back child support issue, I don't read that there was any quarrel or argument as far as the dollar amounts that were factored for either parent, as far as your PIC determination. But tell me what we can do with it from your point of view.
I don't think there's any real error here. There is a typo. the district court used April 1 as the date, but if you do the math as we did in our brief, you can see that she clearly did calculate support starting on July 1. The math wouldn't work out if it was April 1. She used July 1, probably because that's the date that both parties submitted. And that makes sense here. Father didn't have custody or any overnight of the child during the period of the separation. And from that, it is reasonable for the district court to say he has to pay child support for that period of time. So I don't think that a remand is necessary. I don't think a reversal is necessary. That said, we would ask that for the sake of efficiency, if the court thinks there is an error, it either correct it or remand with instructions for the district court to correct it without a hearing.
What about the fact that child support, usually when you're paying arrears, it's 20% of, as Mr. Boulette said, is 20% of what your obligation is, not your total amount.
That's incorrect in a lot of ways. First of all, it's limited to arrears, which both parties agree this was not an arrearage. An arrearage is you were ordered to pay it and you didn't pay it. That's not what this is. That 20% number also in the statute that appellant cites has to do with income withholding. It has to do with how much an employer must withhold from an employee's paycheck. And it's unless the district court orders otherwise. That statute doesn't apply in any way here. There is nothing prohibiting the district court from ordering him to pay back child support all at once, for that matter, which would make sense. After all, he's owed it in the past and she is missing it. The district court actually did him a bit of a mercy by allowing him to pay it over 5 installments instead of all at once. And there's no statute that prohibits the district court from doing that. I appreciate your time. We respectfully ask that the court affirm, and I'll see the rest of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Markowitz. Ms. Willett, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have a few points that I'd like to address, beginning with Judge Werke's request for a syllabus point. I think that the core disagreement between counsel that this court would resolve is whether we understand prejudice to be purely legal prejudice, when a temporary order changes a legal standard, a burden of proof, or the operative statute, or factual prejudice. And statute doesn't limit the prohibition against prejudice just to legal prejudice. It prohibits any prejudice. Now, there is an argument that's being made persistently that MAK is doing wonderfully in Illinois, and so there is no error in saying, why upset the apple cart? But as you point out, Judge Reyes, the district court can't know how MAK would have done in Minnesota because the district court had to make a decision very early without the benefit of full factual findings and in a way that was unappealable, that father couldn't challenge, couldn't appeal, had to live with until this case had been seen all the way through. That creates facts that can be used to directly prejudice father, or they can be used in a non-prejudicial way. So father's syllabus point would be a district court uses a temporary order to prejudice the rights of a child or parent when it bases its final decision on that temporary order, which is what the district court did here. And it didn't just do it implicitly, as counsel implied. It did it explicitly, going out of its way to explain the information it had, incorporating its temporary order, and then taking very much the approach of, well, why would we upset a status quo that is working well enough? But there are a lot of good reasons why we should upset that status quo. And some of the most obvious ones are that the district court itself could not make a schedule or a minimum amount of parenting time work with the residence it chose. It had to deprive father, put father and MAK at an amount of contact below the presumptive minimum. And it found itself in a completely impossible situation, untenable in the words of the custody evaluator, once MAK starts school. This leads us to that second point where parenting time is so important. So counsel says, and I respect the argument, but it's wrong, this is just a reservation of time, which is permitted under 518.175. It's not. If we had any doubts, we look to the district court's order. The district court says very explicitly, here's the schedule until. After that, figure it out. This court doesn't reserve anything.
The district court didn't say figure it out. The district court deferred to the party's agreement to work with a parenting time consultant to figure out how to make it work after child turns 5 and starts school. So I don't think it was necessarily a just kick the can down the road and hopefully things will work out, but I'm not going to get my hands dirty and figure that out now.
But respectfully, Judge Reyes, it kind of is, right? Because you say to parents, well, I'm going to give you reasonable and liberal time, as the parties may agree. That's not what statute requires. Statute requires the court to implement an actual protocol that guarantees some minimum amount of contact with a child for her parent. And we can ask.
But why should the district court insert itself when the parties themselves have agreed to resolve that issue, that very issue, with a parenting time consultant?
Because what the parties agreed is to resolve changes or disagreements or subsequent issues. But there still has to be a baseline. Because if there isn't a baseline, A, what happens when that child turns 5 and we don't have an agreement? But B, to counsel's point, it changes the applicable legal standard. So this court, in a non-precedential opinion, NYB, says even when there is a reservation of time, which is how respondent characterizes this, the parent requesting a change still bears the burden of proof to show all their applicable best interest factors. That means that father in this case actually bears the burden of showing that any continued time with his daughter is in her best interest the minute she turns 5. That's the problem with these with using a temporary order when the statute requires you to make permanent decisions. Yes, things will change, and we have. Oh, sorry, Judge Siegel.
If I could just ask a quick question, there were some early on stipulated agreements as to parenting time. What are we to make of those? Because those do have the child living in Springfield, and it was stipulated. Should we put any weight on that, or how does that in any way change your argument?
I don't think it does, Judge Siegel, because in many ways, those stipulated agreements come after the district court's made its temporary residence decision. And so the parent saying, this is the decision you've made, let's backfill in an actual schedule, I don't think operates to change the analysis that a district court should do or that you would do with the same facts. I see my time is up, so I appreciate the panel's attention and excellent questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. It doesn't look like either of my colleagues have any additional questions. So thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. Both were very well done. And raise, I think, some very important questions for us to consider. So we appreciate it from both of you.